The purpose of Wealth Talk is to educate, inform, and hopefully entertain you on the subject of building your wealth. Wealth Builders recommends you should always take independent financial, tax, or legal advice before making any decisions around your finances.
Welcome to episode 95 of Wealth Talk. My name's Christian Rodwell, the Membership Director for Wealth Builders, and I'm joined today by our founder, Mr. Kevin Whelan. Hi, Kevin.
Hello, Chris. Good to be with you again. And I've been vaccinated as well.
Well, hey.
I'm feeling resolute and steadfast in my determination to bring a little bit of light and inspiration in these troubled times.
Good. One step closer. That's good to hear. And more good news, actually, Kevin. We might as well kick off by letting our listeners know that next Thursday, the 4th of March, we'll be hosting a live webinar. And the purpose of that is really just for anyone who is not currently a member of Wealth Builders in the 7 Steps to Wealth program, but would be interested in just finding out a little bit more about how it works and what we do. So we've put together a webinar, and that's called How You Can Create a Clear Plan Within 60 Days to Build Predictable Recurring Income from Assets, which of course is what we teach people how to do following our step-by-step process. So if you'd like to jump on that and join myself and Kevin, then head to wealthbuilders.co.uk/webinar. And you can register your details right there. So, Kevin, today we're going to mix it up a little bit, and we are going to dedicate this episode to an FAQ session and some of the questions that we get asked within our Wealth Builders community. And we thought we'd just put some of those together, and hopefully the answers will be useful for our listeners today.
Okay. So you're just going to put me on the spot, are you?
I am. I know you will not have any trouble whatsoever, Kevin. So these are questions I know that we get asked commonly. So why don't we kick off with something which is around the emergency fund. And, you know, first and foremost, Kevin, people may or may not have heard of the term emergency fund, but what exactly does that mean?
Well, an emergency fund is, you know, a creature comfort that says, hey, have I got a cushion to bounce on? Do I have a safety net that I just feel like there's a sum of money that if I know it's always there, I kind of feel like I've got a basis and a foundation on which I can move forward and do something else with my finances, whether it's investing, whether it's building wealth, whether it's building assets. So everybody has a number, and it's for you to determine what that number is. Now, of course, there are some kind of standard advisory things that you would see out there in the world. One of those would be, well, how about you think about, which is quite relevant, actually, in terms of one of the metrics we talk about, Chris, when we talk about financial security, which is the amount of recurring income that you need in order for you to meet the cost and the bills of the life that you lead in its kind of basic form. No frills attached, nothing fancy, no really great holidays, nothing, you know, dramatic there. And so that the emergency fund then will probably be that number, or that figure is the amount of month the amount of money you need per month. So let's say, for the sake of an argument, you determine it's 3,000 something dollars or pounds or whatever, the equivalent. Then how many months' income do you want for you to feel safe? Now, standard protocol is 6 months. Others, it could be 12 months, but it's really a matter for you. So just like any wealth building activity and any feeling about finances, it's not really for anybody else other than you to determine what you think is the right number. My personal issue is I think 12 months is a good number because it means you could live for a whole year with money that you already have accessible. And we could talk about where that accessibility should be, Chris, because that's an important thing as well. So it's a combination of having money for security, but also having the money accessible.
Yes. So typically, you know, you would think if you need to get hold of it quickly, you'd want it in just your bank account or savings account. But is there anywhere a bit more efficient that perhaps you could have it placed?
Well, efficiency probably isn't a big measure for emergency fund because it's that feeling. But we know that having money in the bank account probably isn't going to make you feel really happy because interest rates right now are so low. But equally, you don't want to put the money in the stock market because the stock market is not a place for an emergency. It's a medium-term investment. So you mustn't confuse money in the market to money for emergencies. So, you know, a common one in the UK would be some form of, you know, national savings. It could be premium bonds. You can hold £50,000 per person in premium bonds, which is a tax-free prize fund. And I've mentioned this before because for some people, especially if you've got kids as well, it can be a very interesting way to keep your money safe, participate in a prize draw. And it gives you a little, you know, sense of once a month the prizes are announced and you could win a million. It's like playing the lottery, Chris, but getting your money back if you don't win. And I don't think that's a bad thing anyway for an emergency fund. Definitely not a place to build wealth, but it's definitely a reasonable place for an emergency fund. Another one could be anybody who's got a mortgage. Then there are certain types of mortgage. I've written about this in the past, Chris, called an offset mortgage. It's where you can combine what you own with what you owe. So your savings, let's say, and your mortgage sit side by side so that every penny in your savings is essentially paying off your mortgage piece by piece. And that's not a bad thing. Now, I remember I took out an offset mortgage way, way back in the 90s, and that helped me pay my own mortgage off in 7 years flat. And that was a good thing. And it was important to me to pay off my mortgage. And again, that's a question we get a lot, Chris, isn't it? Should I pay off my mortgage either in full or should I pay it off before I start building wealth? And I'm sure that one will come up. But the whole point about this is, like everything, it's about your own personal choice. So if you can look into offset mortgages, if you've got a mortgage, and while interest rates are still relatively low, still higher than you'd pay or you'd be receiving in a bank account in terms of interest. So very smart thing to do is to connect the money that you have in your life with the money that you owe in your life. And little by little, while you still have access to the money, every day you're not using the money, it's paying down your mortgage a little by little.
Great. That answers that one, definitely. Okay, so another one we get is around the topic of debt. And often people asking, should I pay off my debt before I start to build my wealth? What would be your response to that, Kevin?
Well, I'm probably going to say this a lot, Chris, whenever people ask me questions. And the answer is it depends, because you've got to really work out what's important to you. Now, I've mentioned this before, that in a book I wrote called Save a Fortune, How to Eliminate Your Mortgage Loans and Credit Cards Fast. And by the way, anybody who wants a copy of that book on PDF, it's available for free, okay? All you need to do is reach out to us, Chris. What's the place anybody could do that, and we'll send them a copy for free?
Well, it's freely available actually inside our free membership. So if you're not already a member, just head to wealthbuilders.co.uk/membership and you can download it in there.
And in that book, I go into great detail about, you know, whether you should do one thing or the other. But in truth, you know, it's probably a combination. So for some people, they want to secure that place of feeling like they're mortgage-free, consumer debt-free before they build. And then almost all of they've dramatically reduced their expenses of life. And then consequently, they can afford then, with the same level of income, let's say, if they're employed, to turn more attention towards investing and building wealth. I think there's a danger in doing that, that it depends how big your mortgage is. You know, if you've got a big mortgage, you might take many, many years, and that will deny you the opportunity for learning. It will deny you the opportunity for doing two things at the same time. So I'd always say if you can, try and spend some time in eliminating debt. Certainly consumer debt. I would put all my time in eliminating consumer debt first. Certainly do a little stock take and list everything you owe, interest rate by interest rate. And there's a very interesting thing in the book called Marshal the Forces, Chris, which is secret number 4 out of 12 in that book, which just talks about a way you can almost harness the value of everything you're doing by paying off one card and then with the highest debt, then the next one, then the next one, then the next one. So instead of dissipating your energy amongst different cards, you do it all in a very laser-like and focused way. So eliminating consumer debt, definitely, because it's the highest, most likely to be the highest interest rate, although some people play the zero interest game, and that does happen. I'd definitely say, you know, it's only a game you can play for so long. But as soon as you've got your hang of consumer debt, mortgage rates generally quite low. So I think you can afford to spend a bit of time accelerating the debt repayment as far as the mortgage is concerned, but putting some time and effort into wealth building and owning assets. Because in a real way, Chris, and we say this a lot in wealth builders, you expand your way to wealth, you don't contract your way to wealth. Nothing wrong with doing a bit of both, but it's expansion that's the key, not the contraction.
Well, I think that links on nicely to the next question. And we know for many people, Kevin, the light bulb moment came when they read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and, you know, seminal book there. And Robert Kiyosaki, the author, talks about good debt and bad debt. So we just talked about perhaps the bad debt. But our next question is it possible to create wealth without borrowing money?
Yes, it is. You can build wealth in so many different ways. Some assets will require finance, some assets won't require finance. So, you know, using leverage is an interesting thing. I think Robert Kiyosaki himself doesn't refer to it in exactly these words, but almost, I think he says in one of the books, you must regard debt as if it's a loaded gun. You know, it can save you and protect you, but also it can damage. And I like to, I'm not sure I use that terminology myself, but I often refer to debt as a double-edged sword. And a double-edged sword cuts both ways, Chris. So on the one hand, you know, it can work in your favor. So, you know, the example of using banker's debt, if you like, money that bank would loan you to own and control an asset that you can then create more income from the asset than the cost of the debt. It's a tried and trusted method for so many people in property or real estate, as he refers to it. And it's his primary method of building wealth. As he often refers to, you know, four greenhouses, one red hotel. It's a process of building wealth that many people have used. And I think if it managed well, like, as I say, you know, you've got a very sharp tool in the toolbox there. If you manage it well, if you keep your debt levels to a reasonable figure, and again, everybody has a different figure, I tend to think something like 50% keeps you reasonably safe. You know, then you're not really in desperate situation if interest rates go up. Anyway, so I would say you can use debt to enhance your wealth, and I would encourage people to at least understand it. But there are those who prefer to get to a baseline, as I mentioned earlier on. They want to be mortgage-free, they want to be debt-free, and then they want to build their wealth and they want to avoid debt altogether. It's just different strategies. You know, you can run a business. I've got businesses, Chris, we've never borrowed a penny in the bank. Many businesses do borrow money from banks. So it's just a question of your own personality, your own style, your own thoughts about the use of debt leverage, and whether you believe, you know, you want to swish that tool or that sword in that direction or not. It's a matter of personal preference. I would say it's definitely worth understanding, because you cannot get wealthy without some form of leverage. And we know what those forms of leverage are. That's a financial form of leverage. You've got intellectual leverage, so you can bring something to bear there. You can use relationships, so other people collaborating, connecting with you, not necessarily on debt. Systems, so you've got something you're bringing to a way of doing things that other people would buy, like a license, a franchise, something like that. But everybody needs the leverage of time, because it's the one factor that keeps us all tied to society, tied to the way we work, which is, you know, the old 24/7. We can't do any more than that. So getting time leverage is one, or having enough time to spend doing it and to spend some time on wealth is a key.
Okay, let's pause there for a second. And Kevin, thanks for that. And let's head to Trustpilot, because we've had some more reviews come in over the last 7 days, and I'd like to just read out at least one of those. And this one is from Stephen, and he says, a smart move transferring my SIP to a SaaS. So I recently moved my SIP pension into a SaaS operated by Wealth Builders. The process of transfer was seamless, with excellent online trustee training, fully explaining my responsibilities as a trustee of my SaaS prior to the transfer. The flexibility afforded me to invest my pension into a variety of investment strategies means both the risk and reward can be adjusted to suit my personal needs. I am particularly pleased with the growth in the SaaS fund over the last 12 months, and I would have no hesitation in recommending Wealth Builders to anyone considering a SaaS. So thank you, Stephen.
All right. Well, that's a bit of complicated language in there, Chris, isn't it, really? SIP, SaaS, crumbs. You know, that's the whole world of finance. No wonder it's not taught in schools, right? It's just such a cumbersome, opaque set of numbers and language. It's really important, though, when you think about the world of wealth building and wanting to be financially independent, that you have to speak the language of wealth. You have to take some time to understand the language. Language is very powerful. Words are tools. And actually, quite, Chris, you know, I can, if I have a 5-minute conversation with someone and we talk about this subject, I can tell whether they're going to be wealthy or not by the choice of words and language they use. So it's really quite a powerful thing. And I would encourage anybody to spend some time listening, reading, and opening their mind to new words and accepting those words and trying to define the differences and the nuances. Because wealth building is not black, it's not white, it's gray. You have to be able to see the differences and the subtleties and the creativities, which is why I will almost never dispense an opinion, and I'll almost never deal in anything other than broad principles. Because I think if you teach people principles, they can work out how they want to use them. If you come at it like a guru, you know, where you have all the answers and you want people to follow everything that you do, I think that's a false way to give people the creativity, which is where wealth comes from. And SIP is just a self-invested personal pension. There's different language for it in different countries. But pensions are probably the most misunderstood, overlooked and undervalued asset in the whole world. And yeah, what concerns me more than anything else is people don't speak the language. They don't understand the words. And what they don't understand more than anything else, Chris, is the high costs normally associated with having a pension that somebody else is in control. And whether you call it a personal pension, a SIP or whatever, somebody else is in control of the costs and the direction of travel of that vehicle. And wherever it's possible, I would say the person who should be in control or more in control of your wealth building and retirement assets should be you. So the difference between SIP and SaaS, largely small self-administered scheme, Google that, self-invested personal pension. They sound similar things, but they're completely the opposite from each other. One is very much a vehicle that somebody else is in control and you're in the passenger seat saying, I'd like to turn left, I'd like to turn right, and they say yes or no. And a SaaS is a vehicle that you are in the front seat, you're in the driving seat, and you control where you want to go. And the thing about the way SaaSes work, Chris, more than anything else, is a SaaS is an administrative cost. So it's you who do the work. You choose the investments. You're the one who decides. Do you want to invest in property? Do you want to invest in stocks? Do you want to invest in ETFs? Do you want to invest in gold? What do you want to invest in? You can. And because the costs tend to be administrative-only costs, not a proportion of the wealth that's in the pot. Most conventional pensions and the whole industry charges, you know, typically 1.5 to 2% of the value of the money in the pot. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, does it? 1.5%? But if you imagine, you know, you're building up a pot and you've got, say, 300,000 in your pot, that's £4,500 in fees, you know, just for somebody else being in control of that. And that gets higher and higher and higher. So the industry shares more of the value the more successful your pot is. Whereas my experience with SaaS is if people can control their own return, they will drive a higher return. If they control their own costs, they'll drive lower costs. And when you combine a turbocharge to a vehicle and reducing the handbrake, you know, taking the handbrake off, the vehicle's going to go quicker. And that's my experience. So I'm glad that, you know, we've got a testimony from someone who's learned the difference, has applied the difference, and then they're going to take that money, get a higher return, faster vehicle, less cost, no restriction on that, and they should be able to therefore build a bigger retirement income and leave a better and stronger legacy for the next generation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, you mentioned there the SIP stands for self-invested personal pension, but even though you're self-investing, it's almost always still in the markets. And another question that we get asked, Kevin, I know this is a difficult one to answer, but I'm going to ask you anyway, because people ask us, is now a good time to start investing in the stock market? And I know with your economist background, you probably have got something to say.
Well, the stock market is a place to invest money. And we know that if you study economics or study the markets, as I've done in the past and continue to do now, Chris, you know, it is a predictable tool for wealth, but it's more about protecting wealth. The challenge I have with the stock market is if you think about what it does, it's a long-term hold vehicle. Now, the long-term trend for the average investor, I won't go into the details of it, Chris, but let's just say for the sake of an argument, the value of that would be a long-term return of, say, 6% gross return, which, of course, is better than having money in cash. But the challenge with that is it comes with incredible volatility. So in broad terms, whenever you're buying into the stock market, if you imagine that the range of returns you'd be getting might be somewhere between plus 30 and minus 15, but the average return might be 5-6%. So what you don't know is where you're going to be on that spectrum. And 95 years and 100, that's probably what's going to happen. You're going to be on a good year, you'll be plus 20, 25, plus 26. In a bad year, minus 10, minus 12. But we're getting more and more black swan events, more and more occasions when the negative is much larger than what would normally be predicted in that 95-year experience. And we're seeing, like we saw in 2008, ordinary people seeing 35 to 40% of their retirement savings wiped. We saw it again in 2020. You know, when are we going to see it again? And the challenge with this, Chris, investing in the stock market, is understanding that the price of getting that return is that huge volatility. And the other thing that's then missed is the high costs that are often associated with that. I mentioned it earlier on. If you're paying 1.5 to 2%, and you're paying that whether the market goes up, whether the market goes down, then essentially you're in a joint venture relationship with the financial industry where they're making money, whether you make money. You're putting in all the money for risk. They're putting in none of their money for risk. And there's no accountability if it goes wrong. So my fear is because people over concentrate their investments in the stock market because it's an easy thing to delegate. And it's they're kind of put in there, aren't they, from their employer, or they kind of see it as an easy fit because pensions, generally speaking, and investments like ISAs and other things tend to be stock market based. You know, there's a whole reason for that because it keeps an industry in profit, and it's probably one of the biggest industries in the UK and the US. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the stock market per se because it's companies making profits. I'm just saying it's better to look at building wealth in many different things, which we refer to as pillars, many different assets, and not over concentrate ever on one.
Okay, and that leads on to the question of wealth management companies and IFAs, and does someone need one? What exactly is the purpose of one, and how does Wealth Builders differ from an IFA?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, I suppose Wealth Builders, sometimes people can assume it's a wealth management company, but wealth management companies and advisory companies generally fall into two categories. Those who are managing money, you know, like fund managers or have a discretionary management plan, which is delegate your money to us and we'll manage that money in some form of set of rules and systems. And usually some form of advisor is number one is choosing the method of which you're making the investment. So more often than not, the advisors are not investment smart. They don't really do the investment. They're just a conduit. It's the intermediation that, you know, they're putting you in contact, they're brokering a relationship. Now, I don't have any, again, I have nothing to say about good managers and bad managers in terms of managing money. It's just impossible to pick, right? So I don't believe there's any evidence at all. I believe there's no evidence at all that one manager consistently outperforms anything. I think my view simplistically is if you're going to invest in the stock market, the best thing you can do is invest in the lowest cost way possible. If that's all you want to do is delegate your money, or try and make your investment a combination of low cost, but at the same time, some reflection of your own personality. So what do you like? You know, are you particularly interested in green energy? Are you particularly interested in something that you can make your investing part of who you are, but also just be mindful of costs? I think the big thing that worries me about the way people just invest their money in blind way, just following what they've been told in the past, historical stuff, and their employer just does it for them. You know, usually the employer is picking up the costs anyway. So if you're with an employer, that's probably a good thing to do because the costs are being paid by them. But as soon as you come out of that, you end up paying handsomely for what really is very simple skills. Skills that you can learn in the stock market over a weekend. Somebody sticking a siphon in your life for decades. And I think the time has come for that sacred cow to be shot and for that rule to be changed and for people to invest in the lowest cost way possible. And that's what I'm trying to do for our community, is just give access to the stock market at the lowest possible cost, because that's going to give the best possible outcome for our members and for our clients. Mm.
Okay, thank you for that one, Kevin. And one more, I think we can probably just squeeze in. And this is one that comes up often as well, and it's around life insurance. So a few different questions. How much insurance do I need? You know, what's the purpose of insurance? And, you know, do you need life insurance after you've retired?
Well, what does retirement mean? I mean, there's so many huge questions here. Should I save for retirement? What is retirement? You know, retirement is bit of an interesting concept, Chris, isn't it really? If you think about where the whole retirement idea came from, it was, you know, when historical, you know, situations where you'd work for one employer, you'd work hard all of your life and you retire at 65 and you live to 70 maybe, you know, and you were tired, you know, you were put out to pasture, you know, your entire life was sort of came to an end. It was almost like a crossroads, a new chapter. I don't think retirement is existing the same way now. I mean, often people who meet me say, why do you still do what you do? You know, you could retire. Why aren't you? Well, it's because retirement doesn't have that same meaning for me. As long as I'm enjoying what I'm doing, as long as I feel I'm making a contribution, and as long as I feel like I'm still learning something and still getting some joy from that, I'll continue to do it. So I think retirement means different things. So let's not worry about whether you should have life cover after retirement. Let me give you a perspective on life cover. Life cover is insurance. And the purpose of insurance generally is to put yourself in a situation that you want to be in. Now, putting aside insurance for cars and houses where you want to, basically, if you lose the car, you lose the house, you want to be put in the same position. Life insurance is different. Life insurance, to me, is about putting your family in the position you want them to be in. So not the position they're in today, but the position you want them to be in. So, Chris, we talk a lot about financial security, financial independence. Okay. So if you've chosen a number that would give you financial security and you've chosen a number to give you financial independence, and there's often quite a big difference between the two, then life insurance, which basically pays out a lump sum if you die, if you predecease your spouse and children, then what you would consider, I think, is, well, what do you want that life cover value to be relative to the amount of money they need to be secure or independent? Let's give you an example. Say you choose a figure of, well, I gave it earlier on, 3,000 a month, okay, for security. Let's say your security figure is 3,000 a month and your independence figure was $6,000 a month, just for a number, okay? Then what you've got to do is do two things. Number one is you have to work out, well, what is your family, because you're not going to be there now, capable of generating as an income from a lump sum, right? So you've got to work that out. Well, let me give you the best guess I can. Well, we did it earlier on. If you put it in the stock market, your family had a lump sum, they put it in the market, and they were getting gross six, net four, then four is probably a reasonable number. So, okay. So if you want them to have £3,000 a month or £36,000 a year, then what you need is to say, well, if my family can get four, then I need 25 times that figure. So, okay, not an easy number to calculate if it's £3,000 a month. Going back then, Chris, 25 times 36, which is 900. I probably should have made it 40,000. Then we could have all done the maths together, couldn't we, at a million? But if, you know, if we're talking about 900,000 to a million, let's say, in life cover, then that's the sort of figure you would need for your family to be in a position of financial security. Now, the question is, what other cover have you got? What other assets have you got? What other recurring income do you have in your life, if any? Then you can eliminate that. So the job of insurance, if you've got no assets at all, is to provide your family with security or independence. And then it's just a question of affordability. So if the cost of getting £1 million with the cover was £100 a month, and you can't afford £100 a month, then you invest what you can afford. And then, of course, you've recognized there's a gap between what you wanted, and that's just life. Or you find a way to afford it by either, you know, doing something else in your life, whether it's reviewing all of your costs in other areas through the debits process, Chris, whether you find another source of income that generates you £100 a month, or ideally you find your first asset that generates £100 a month. And then the money that's generated from your very first asset is what you use to pay for the insurance. See what I mean? So you know, the key thing is to generate income from assets, and then you can use the income that comes from the assets to do what it is that you want to do. So that would be how I would do it. And then as you build your assets over time, you start to scale back the insurance. So you get to a place where, in the end, when you've reached financial independence, now for most people, that's a 5 to 7 year journey. So you don't need to be taking out life cover for 25, 30 years unless you're not committed to your own wealth. So you can see that insurance can be a very low-cost item for a period of years, maybe only a handful of years, and then you're protecting your family as well as you can, but at the same time, you're doing so deliberately and conscientiously, not just buying an insurance policy and just paying the premium for 25 and 30 years.
Yeah. No, that makes complete sense. And you mentioned about recurring assets there, Kevin. So before we wrap up today, I'll remind our listeners, if you enjoyed listening today and you'd like to find out how you can begin building recurring income and how we help our members to put a clear plan together within 60 days, and then jump on the webinar with Kevin and myself next week on Thursday, the 4th of March. We'll be starting at 7:30 p.m. and you can register by heading to wealthbuilders.co.uk/webinar. And Kevin, thank you very much for that today. I'm sure people will have picked up a few things, which perhaps, you know, they may have known, but it's always good to hear these things again, isn't it?
Well, I think it's about financial intelligence, Chris. And financial intelligence is not as easy to measure as doing a Mensa test and getting your IQ. Financial intelligence is about the ability to make distinctions and differences and points of view that come from understanding all of the choices. So essentially, it's about knowing there are many things to do and involving yourself in the thinking that allows you to work out which is the right thing for you. And that's what financial intelligence is. And I think for the most part, I think too many people are told what to do or they accept what to do from their parents or their employer or just tradition. And as a result, they don't understand the distinctions. They can't make those distinctions for themselves. And when you can't do that, your financial intelligence is low. And low financial intelligence is a much slower path to creating wealth. So what we want to do, Chris, is give as many people distinctions and differences and try and help them build their financial IQ so that they can become financially independent on their own terms.
Well, we hope you enjoyed listening today, and we'll be back with another episode of Wealth Talk. Same time, same place, Kevin.
Okay, Chris. Until then, my friend. See ya.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Don't forget that we are constantly updating our resources inside the Wealth Builders membership site to help you create, build, and protect your wealth. Head over to wealthbuilders.co.uk/membership right now for free access. That's wealthbuilders.co.uk/membership.